Ramon Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. Me, Martinez. The Trump administration wants to send more water to farmers in Central California. Sounds nice, but what if doing that means disaster for endangered species like the Chinook salmon and then the killer whales that eat them? We'll hear proposed water changes for the state are based on the best available science. Plus, how a multi-billion dollar banking fortune bankrolled hardline anti-immigration policy. It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks, as always, for listening to one of the coolest shows on the radio on one of the hottest days of the year. Coming up later on the show, we speak with a reporter and photographer behind the five-part series on homelessness in the LA Times. Turns out that ending homelessness isn't as easy as giving people a permanent place to live. That's coming up in about half an hour. Plus, also on the lot, our weekly look at all the news out of Hollywood. First, though, water. California salmon could be in danger if the Trump administration moves forward with its plan to deliver more water to the Central Valley. Now, that's according to a federal assessment that was never released. It was, however, obtained by the LA Times, which reports that steelhead trout, killer whales, and other creatures protected by the Endangered Species Act would be harmed by the federal government's water plan. Joining us now is Noah Oppenheim. He's executive director of the Institute for Fisheries Resource. Joins us now by phone. Noah, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
Now, tell us what species in California would be affected if this federal water plan does indeed go through.
Sure. So dozens of species would certainly be affected. But in terms of species that are listed under the Endangered Species Act and managed by the National Marine Fisheries Service, we know of four. That's the winter run and spring run Chinook salmon. Those are also known as king salmon, and the summer or Central Valley steelhead trout, and the southern resident killer whales, which are a subspecies of orcas that exclusively consume salmon.
Okay, so let's specifically talk about the winter run Chinook salmon already at the risk of extinction. How would that species be affected under this plan?
Sure. So this species is already teetering on the brink. It has been for some time. In fact, the National Marine Fisheries Service has said that it, of the ESA-listed endangered species that it manages, it is one of the top nine most likely to go extinct in the near future. So this run of salmon is on the brink. It's precarious. Now, when we operate the Federal Water Project, which is the massive system of dams and diversions that store water and then pump it to the Central Valley Project, California Aqueduct, and to federal water contractors in the Central Valley, we do so in order to deliver water at times that agriculture needs it. Now, that's exactly the time that fish need that water. So this plan would further shift the hydrology of the Sacramento River in favor of ag deliveries and away from what this perilously endangered fish needs to survive.
So, no, it sounds like there's no give and take here. If the farmers get that water, the fish will definitely suffer. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there's certainly a balance. There are always going to be water deliveries to agriculture. The question is, will there be more? And under this plan, it is about more. And it is about so much that, according to the fish agency, it would lead to jeopardy and eventually extinction of the species.
Where does that water coming from, for clarification's sake?
Sure. So it's coming mostly from rain and snowmelt from storms that reach mountains and other high elevation areas, and then is stored behind dams in reservoirs. The Federal Water Project principally uses water stored behind the Shasta Dam, Keswick Dam, in Lake Shasta. Those flows are then regulated according to a planned system by the Central Valley Project. And the Bureau of Reclamation operates those facilities, releasing water into the river, timed to both protect, in many cases, ESA-listed fish. Under the current status quo, we have some fairly protective provisions in there. And, of course, to deliver water to water users through the pumps in the Delta.
We're talking to Noah Oppenheim, Executive Director of the Institute for Fisheries Resource. Noah, you represent fishermen, but these species that we're talking about are endangered. So just, they're not available to be fished at the moment, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the winter run and spring run Chinook salmon are not targeted by commercial fishermen in California. In fact, we take some pretty significant measures to avoid them. Those fish, as is implied by their name, upmigrate into the river systems in the winter and spring. Commercial fishermen haven't fished during the times when the majority of these runs take place for several decades now. And our seasons are managed in order to prevent those impacts. So we've been managed under ESA constraints for decades now, and commercial fishermen in California take these conservation responsibilities very seriously. We've been working to protect these fish for decades and are certainly not seeking their extinction. They're not in the way right now. We need these fish and the flows that they need in order to harvest the runs of salmon that are important for fishermen's bottom line.
So with all that in mind, then, what's your bone to pick in this fight?
Well, if this water plan is put into effect, then we will see further constraints, of course, on fishing driven by further declines to those ESA-listed fish. But also, this draft biological opinion showed that the water project would result in significant declines in the abundance of the harvested runs, the ones that we do count on, that are born and reared in the Central Valley and the Sacramento River in particular. That's where the southern resident killer whale component comes in. The whales, of course, are salmon eaters, and if we don't have fish to feed the whales and to feed fishermen, and feed the people who love their California seafood, then we all suffer, frankly. And we need to increase, not decrease, the number of fish coming out of the Central Valley.
You know, Noah, this is just seems like a very tough economic question for some, because it's jobs either on farms or jobs at stake at fisheries. Is it that simple? Is it that black and white, this question?
You know, in some ways it is. Take, for example, the mass balance equation of this situation. You either pump more water than the fish can handle, or you pump less water in order to irrigate less acreage of the Central Valley. It's jobs versus jobs. It's not fish versus water in this situation. In this case, our jobs are the ones that have been threatened the most. We, for example, have seen the loss of over 90% of commercial fishing jobs in salmon since the early 80s. We had about 4,500 commercial salmon boats in 1983. Today, we have fewer than 450 active commercial fishermen fishing salmon in a given year. So we've certainly seen massive declines. Meanwhile, corporate Central Valley agriculture profits are through the roof. And, you know, even during the most recent drought, nut tree crops were more valuable than ever, more acreage under irrigation for nut tree crops than in the past. So certainly I think the system is out of balance, and this Trump plan to exacerbate this imbalance would further cement, you know, losses in the fishery and the fishing industry.
Noah Oppenheim, Executive Director of the Institute for Fisheries Resource. Noah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, keeping with water, picture this. Water flowing down a stream, wildlife frolicking, and 50 feet away, rush hour traffic piling up on the 5. Yep, that's the LA River, 51 miles of water that cuts through nearly all of Los Angeles County, starting in Canoga Park and heading down to Long Beach. Each summer, the city opens up two sections of the river to the public, at the Sepulveda Basin and in Elysian Valley. And one of the most popular recreational activities during this time, right, kayaking. We sent KPCC's Ari Saperstein out on the water to learn more.
Steve Appleton has led tours for a lot of kayakers on the LA River over the past 6 years.
I can tell you exactly. I don't know the numbers for this year, but up until this year was 7,324.
And as owner of LA River Kayak Safari, he's about to add a few more.
11, 12. Yeah, we got everybody's here. Awesome. How many of you guys have been over in this area before or know anything about it?
Only a couple of people raised their hands.
How many people had somebody make a joke about the fact they're coming to the LA River? Yeah.
Everybody puts a hand up. See, the thing about the LA River is that it's better known for its concrete than its water. For most Angelenos, the river has been concretized their entire life because, well, it's been paved for more than 80 years now, which is part of the reason it's best known as a backdrop for, of all things, car chases in films like Transformers, The Terminator, and Grease.
The rules are there ain't no rules.
If you're used to the car chase scene of the LA River, this section, Elysian Valley, clearly it's not that.
It's hard to imagine now, but in the 1930s, the LA River had too much water in it, and it flooded constantly. So the city paved and deepened the waterway to stop it from overflowing, and it worked. But the LA River, as a natural environment, was decimated. Well, most of it.
Here, they could not pump enough water out of the bottom of this thing, so the bottom in this section does not have concrete on it.
Sure enough, the Elysian Valley section looks more primed for a boat chase than a car chase. It looks like a river. All around, people are fishing, walking along the water, exploring the islands and the river, thanks, in part, to kayaking.
It was about 8 years ago, a group of kayakers paddled the whole LA River. Well, to be clear, they didn't paddle everywhere because sometimes they're pulling their boat through concrete, but they proved the navigability of the river. Within a few years, you're going to be able to go all the way on this path, all the way to the ocean from Canoga Park.
Eventually. Our group is definitely not going to the ocean today. Our short trip starts near Atwater Village, and it ends around the Silver Lake Echo Park border.
So what we're gonna do from here is we're gonna get helmets on. Try to follow single file.
As the tour begins, the group gets off to a rocky start, literally. The first quarter mile is pretty shallow and the guides are constantly helping kayakers whose boats get stuck on rocks.
You guys are good. You guys are really good. Now you're stuck. I'm gonna help you. So try to turn down here. Now you're going to get caught. I'm going to turn you over to the right there. There you go. So turn to the right hard. Turn right. Oh, boy.
Soon enough, we get the hang of it, and we're gliding through the water with ease. But the rocks aren't the only challenge. See, even though we're surrounded by nature, the city is hard to escape.
Right after we launch, we go under the 2 freeway. And you're just starting to engage with some of the bucolic aspects of the river. And looking up, you're seeing cars overhead, and it's quite loud.
But then the cityscape fades away, and natural sounds abound.
There's just a lot of birds down there. Black-crowned night herons, egrets. There are osprey in the river. So the bird sounds are a big one, and there's several little rapids in the river here where we drop down through narrower sections of rock, and it's class 1.5 to 2 little rapids, and we get all people prepped up for that and get them through. See, there's this little white water down there. Head for it, and then down that little drop. Sweep with your right hand. Sweep with the right hand.
I mean, class 2 rapids? Not what we were expecting. Getting through them prompts sighs of relief all around.
Oh! Yeah.
And finally, we approach the last stop on our kayaking adventure.
There are some big ponds where the water's as deep as 12, 13 feet deep, and it's very quiet, and it's very remote. It's truly that moment where you're like, what? I'm in the middle of Los Angeles? Could this be possible?
It's true. The absence of city sound, it really is remarkable. Until...
You can do some kayak yoga and stretching. We do have a stretch that we do. You just lean back. Feels really good.
So maybe you can never fully escape the city, but that does not seem to detract from the experience.
I loved it.
That's Emma Ramirez. She's one of the other kayakers on the tour.
Growing up in LA, the idea of a river, that form of recreation being accessible, sounds kind of ridiculous because what everyone knows about the LA River is that most of it is concrete. It felt good to be in water, and I think it felt humbling to be able to do that in the place I call my home.
Kayaking the LA River, it really did feel good. Street traffic, helicopters, and all. For Take Two, I'm Ari Saperstein.
The vocabulary of hardline immigration rhetoric the last few years ranges from America's being invaded by immigrants to the U.S.-Mexico border needs to be sealed. Social media makes it all feel very loud, but it definitely is not something new. Its seeds of thought have been sown for a long time now, but coming up, we'll hear how the heiress to a multi-billion dollar banking fortune bankrolled anti-immigration policy we hear today. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Cordelia Scaife May not be a household name, but her influence has reached inside the homes of many Americans. She was an heiress to the Mellon banking and industrial fortune, enjoying connections with the Carnegies and the Rockefellers throughout her life. At one point, she was among the wealthiest women in the country, and all that money helped her pursue a controversial passion, limiting immigration to the United States in all forms. Traces of her beliefs can still be found in immigration policy today. Reporters Nicholas Kulish and Mike McIntyre explored May in depth for the New York Times. And Nicholas Kulish joins me now from New York. Welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start from the very beginning. Even though May grew up surrounded by wealth, her family life was really anything but idyllic. How would you describe her upbringing and how that shaped her?
Sure. I think people have fallen back on the poor little rich girl stereotype at times. She was raised in a mansion outside of Pittsburgh, mostly by governesses and nannies. Her mother was an alcoholic, and she's described her childhood as extremely unhappy.
Now, in her younger life, she took an interest in feminism and environmental causes, things that might be considered progressive today. But over time, she switched her focus from the environment to immigration. Why did her ideals change?
Well, you know, I think that part of what happened was just that the world around her changed. I mean, she remained committed to environmental causes throughout her life. And she sort of saw population and environment as going hand in hand. If you keep having more people, you have to pave over more wetlands, you have to build more houses, disrupt more migratory routes for her beloved birds. And during the baby boom, advocating for birth control was one of the top ways to prevent that. But once the baby boom had tailed off and the U.S. birth rate had dropped a lot, it was immigration that was the source of those additional people, those habitat-disrupting people that she didn't want.
There's a moment in her life that kind of accelerates her fervent beliefs, a tragedy, and that helps bring maybe a little more context to May and her evolving thoughts. So what happened? What was the tragedy?
You know, May had had a companion for much of her life, a friend from childhood, someone she had wanted to date, but her family had disapproved. And after a divorce from an approved marriage, she basically spent much of her life with this gentleman, Robert Duggan, who was the prosecutor for the county that includes Pittsburgh. He became embroiled in a corruption controversy and was pursued criminally and ultimately indicted. And he, according to the police, he took his own life with a shotgun. And the whole thing also caused a huge rift with her brother. And so cost her two of the people closest to her in the whole world.
What happened, though, that made her beliefs kind of evolve into what we know her as?
You know, that key moment in 1974 when her husband kills himself, she just seems to sour a little bit. Her letters that we find take on a much harder edge than previously. And she falls in with some people who also committed to the cause of reduced population and reducing immigration. I think that they kind of carry her in this direction to some extent.
She really tries to kind of attach herself to vehicles for the movement of population control. Tell us more about that.
In her early years, she was friendly with Margaret Sanger, who was one of her grandmother's closest friends, and that was sort of her entry point into the birth control issue.
Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, right?
The founder of Planned Parenthood, exactly. She later worked on something called the Population Council with John D. Rockefeller III, to which she and some other members of her family donated enormous sums, you know, millions of dollars in the 1960s. After the death of her husband, you know, she resigned from Planned Parenthood after more than two decades working with the group. She resigned from the Population Council. And she threw in with a group called the Environmental Fund, which was the first organization that she had been involved with that explicitly called for reduced immigration as one of its goals. And through the Environmental Fund, she met a very influential figure both in her life and American history, Dr. John Tanton.
And she also helps establish the nation's three largest anti-immigration groups, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, Numbers USA, and the Center for Immigration Studies. She does this, though, kind of below the radar, right? It's almost as if she doesn't want anyone to know that she's behind these things.
Exactly. Dr. Tanton, who I just referred to, is really sort of the public face. He's viewed almost like a character out of a Frank Capra movie, right? Or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. He's this humble ophthalmologist who lives in Michigan and spends one day a week founding public pressure groups. And so he's really the front person for this. But what we discovered in our reporting was that he basically could not have founded these groups without her money. We knew that she was a donor, but we did not realize the extent to which she was essentially the key person who allowed him to create almost this empire of anti-immigration groups.
And it wasn't as if Cordelia May just simply funded them and didn't want anyone to talk about it. I mean, she would go as far as to tell people to destroy correspondence.
Yeah, you know, the research for this was very difficult. And we would, you know, my colleague Mike McIntyre and I would turn up, you know, in an archive where there was promised a folder of correspondence back and forth between Mrs. May and you know, another figure. And sure enough, it would just be the letters to her. And the letters from her would be gone. And then in a couple places it said, you know, we burned that letter like you asked to. And that was why we realized it was really hard to sort of track down her ideas and like her thinking beyond the fact that she was sort of serving as this, you know, money woman.
Talking to Nicholas Coolidge from the New York Times, from your research, the influx of immigrants in the 70s further shifts her views. She defends herself, though, as not having racially motivated or elitist beliefs. And you mentioned how you got your eyes on some of that personal correspondence. It kind of contradicts that defense, doesn't it? It just some of the things read a little questionable.
I mean, even her defense, I mean, she says that, you know, she wishes that we could just put paper bags over the heads of the immigrants so that we would count their deleterious numbers instead of talking about, you know, what races they were and being accused of being racist, which is not, you know, even in itself, I mean, just the idea of wanting to put bags over all of their heads.
Yeah.
But she's not complaining in her writings about how many Norwegians are showing up in Minnesota or how many Canadians, like John Tanton's father, are crossing the border into Michigan. She talks about the Filipinos pouring into Hawaii. She talks about the, quote, in her words, Orientals illegally crossing the northern border. She talks about people from Latin America pouring into Florida. And she even says that Cuban refugees, quote, breed like hamsters. So, you know, her preoccupations, I think, say a lot.
So the whole reason we're talking about Cordelia Scaife Maine right now is that you discovered that her views are now mirrored in current policy. Words like invasion, building a wall on the southern border, more recently reducing public services to legal immigrants. As it turns out, can we legitimately point to Cordelia as the source maybe for some of this movement?
The movement doesn't get off the ground without her money. Now, that doesn't mean that people who are concerned, you know, about their jobs or who, as a result of offshoring and outsourcing and globalization, you know, have some problems and that they feel that the added competition of immigrants in low-wage jobs wouldn't still feel that way. You know, the larger things that are at play in the world would still be at play. But the idea of a decades-long action of research, grassroots, you know, all the things that these organizations have been able to do. Without her, that doesn't happen the way that it did.
Nicholas, you really dug deep into Cordelia May, seeing all the things she wrote and really researched this in depth. If she were alive today, how do you think she would feel about the way this current administration sees immigration policy?
Right. I think the key word is when it comes to immigration, I think that she would be I think that she would be very happy with the policies that President Trump has pursued, many of which, you know, have come from the playbook of the groups that she funded. I don't think that she would be happy about sort of, you know, drilling in Alaska or rolling back, you know, protections for endangered species. But as far as the immigration issue goes, this is well in line with her beliefs.
That was Nicholas Kulish from The New York Times telling us about the heiress who for four decades influenced immigration policy in the U.S. Nicholas, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Here's something that might surprise you. Most of the money California parents pay in child support does not actually go to their kids. It goes to the government. But as KQED politics correspondent Marisa Lagos reports, there's a move to change that.
Daddy, we went to Chuck E. Cheese.
You went to Chuck E. Cheese?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
36-year-old Thomas Lamb Jr. says he's always tried to do right by his kids. But for a while, Lamb found himself in an untenable situation. His child support payments were eating up most of his income, too much for him to still spend money on his daughters when they were with him. The thing is, the money wasn't reaching his kids and their mom either. Since they were on government assistance, just $50 of the $1,000 being taken out of Lamb's paycheck was actually being passed on to his ex. The rest was going to pay back the government for the welfare benefits his ex was receiving.
It felt like it was like, what's the point of working? Like, they're taking all this money. I still have to pay for my kids' food, clothes, and all this other stuff. But it seemed impossible to do all of that.
Making matters worse, since Lamb had fallen behind on payments, the state was charging 10% interest. All told, he owed $6,000. And if he didn't pay, he could lose his driver's license or even go to jail. Lamb is not alone. Studies show that 70% of child support debt in California is owed to the government, and the vast majority of parents paying child support make less than $10,000 a year. State Senator Nancy Skinner.
Well, it's so absurd.
Skinner is one of several lawmakers trying to change that. She has a bill that would increase the amount families get from $50 a month to $200. Another bill would eliminate the interest charged on child support debt. Skinner noted that for a parent working for minimum wage, a few hundred dollars a month is a lot of money.
Because what we're doing is we're trying to get blood from a turnip, you know, blood from a stone, as they say.
A group of anti-poverty organizations recently joined together with state and local government to see what would happen if parents like Thomas Lamb could wipe out their child support debt. The Urban Institute study being released today found that the parents paid child support more consistently, their relationships with their kids improved, and they were more likely to get jobs and get their own finances in order.
But then to think that $200 you are then turning over supposedly to your family every month only ends up being $50 that they get, I mean, what's your motivation? You would have no motivation.
Skinner and others hope that by changing the system, more parents can get right with their children. For the California Report, I'm Marisa Lagos.
It can be easy to make assumptions about LA's homeless. Some might think that many prefer the freedom of living outside, or that once a homeless person gets housing, that everything changes and they leave street living on the sidewalk. Coming up, a couple of people spent over a year tracking folks who went from encampment to home. Hear how many of those homeless myths get busted by reality. That's next when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Amy Martinez. At last count, more than 44,000 people can be found sleeping on the streets of L.A. County. When it comes to solutions, we talked earlier this year with L.A. County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas. He said that some of the money raised by the measures designed to fight homelessness was spent on ambitious projects to give people a roof over their heads.
They went into that encampment, and now approximately 100 of those individuals have permanent supportive housing.
But this past week, the LA Times unveiled a five-part series that followed some of these people. And it turns out that ending homelessness isn't as easy as just giving people a home. The series is called The Street Within. With me in studio now is the reporter, Thomas Kerwin, and the photographer, Francine Orr. Thomas, Francine, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you, eh?
Thank you.
All right, let's start out with the premise of this program run by the county. It's called Encampment to Home. Thomas, walk us through how it's supposed to work.
The typical way of getting people off the streets involves identifying candidates, vetting them, and putting together as much of the paperwork as necessary in order to get the subsidies lined up for them. Then they go out trying to find housing for these individuals. In this particular case, they began with housing. Two apartment buildings down on El Segundo Boulevard and the 110 freeway. And with these two buildings available, they decided that they would start looking at two neighborhoods in Los Angeles that were particularly impacted by encampments. One of these neighborhoods was on the Mert Park, and the other was on Broadway, surround Martin Luther King Boulevard.
And what did they do with those encampments?
They sort of blitzed on these particular encampments and began to work very quickly to get their paperwork cleared and to get their subsidies secured so that they'd be able to move these individuals off the street into these apartments by June.
Now, Thomas and Francine, your series followed several people who were in the program for months. Tell us who they are and how you found them, Francine.
Well, number one, Big Mama. We saw her the first day that we met her. She was recovering after a back injury. She was crying. She was tired. She was in pain. She's funny. She can be a real spark plug.
Thomas, I mean, the people that you selected to be part of this, how did you find them?
Well, when we first started going out there, we met a group of gentlemen who were on the side of the street playing a game of chess. And I walked up to them and introduced them and told them what I was hoping to do. They all turned to me and said, well, you have to meet Big Mama. She's mm-hmm. been out here the longest. She'd been out on Broadway Place for 9 years. And when we met Big Mama, as Francine says, her personality just took one us. And with her help, we began to speak with some of her neighbors.
Francine, tell us about some of her neighbors, Big Mama's neighbors.
Well, Top Shelf, specifically. She has dignity. She's clean. She makes an effort to keep organized. Her nails are done. Mm-hmm. She cooks on the street. She's also incredibly funny, just like her buddy, Big Mama. There was Nisi. Nisi has really struggled her entire life. And the three of them were great friends.
And when it comes to Top Shelf and Nisi, are they pseudonyms? Are they the real names of these people?
They're their nicknames.
Their nicknames, okay.
Yeah.
These are their street names, and they prefer to be known by that. They refer to their regular names as their government names.
Oh, okay.
And so they feel that their street names allow them to put a little bit of distance between the present and their past that they're trying to move away from in one form or another.
Now, once these people got the keys to an apartment, it wasn't just that simple. There are some life skills that they never learned. And one line, Thomas, in your series goes, quote, maybe they didn't know what being a good neighbor meant. Maybe they never saw someone maintain a home. Thomas, can you give us some examples of the ways they struggled?
You have to be able to set boundaries. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the issues that Nisi in particular had a difficult time doing. We would visit her and the comings and goings in her apartment were incessant. A lot of friends from the street would be stopping in, would be crashing, would be staying past what the apartment managers wanted and staying longer than 14 days. That put her in violation of the rules and regulations for the building, and that was ultimately one of the reasons why I believe she had to relinquish her apartment.
Oh, wow.
I mean, out on the street, you don't have too much responsibility. Yeah. You're pretty wide open to, you're calling your own shots, but suddenly you're in a community. You have to be mindful of your neighbors and mindful of the people that are trying to manage these buildings.
Also, Nisi, I think sometimes people feel guilty that they got housed and their friends didn't get housed, and they want to help them.
I remember one occasion where it was raining, and I caught Big Mama on a porch there looking out into the courtyard as the rain was falling. And she was very pensive and very sort of sad at that moment. And I asked her what she was thinking, and she said, you know, we found our place here, but I'm still thinking about all the people that are out there on the street. She went on to say that she'd received some calls from people who were asking her if they could come visit, and she knew that a visit would often be more than just a day. It might linger for a day or two or possibly a week. And she told me that she had to say no.
Talking to Thomas Kerwin and photographer Francine Orr about their series in the LA Times called The Street Within. Francine, you took a lot of pictures in this series. What was the thing that, say, jumped out at you that most surprised you?
I think when everyone moved into their homes, the very first thing that I witnessed people talking about is wanting to have their children back with them, that reconnection to their families. On the street, I think many people felt thrown away, and every single person referenced wanting to have their children at home. Keith, for example, had lost his wife and a daughter to a genetic disease. His daughter was living in a nursing home. He was talking to his mother the day he moved in, asking, "Can we bring my daughter at least for a visit?" He was never able to do that. Since he has moved into his apartment, he has lost his second daughter.
Wow. Thomas, the hurdles in place for people who to even qualify for these units is very, very tough to get over. One person described it as a grinding bureaucracy. What did their experiences tell you about how the process works to get out of homelessness for a homeless person?
You have to be able to endure mountains and mountains of paperwork. I remember being in one interview session, as they called it, which was more of an opportunity for this paperwork to get processed. And I think I counted about 15 or so signatures going on different forms in the course of an hour or so as they were explained all the details and the minutiae of their new living situations. And you have to be willing to have your background completely checked. They do police checks. They do a credit history, of course. You have to do something called a certification of homelessness. The paperwork is extraordinary. I think it's more than people who are housed have to put up with just to get them off the street. And for people that are living on the street, this is daunting. I mean, they're asked to hold on to their paperwork, and often we would visit them and they would hold large envelopes and sort of clutch them, and this would be the paperwork that was so important to them that often could get lost. When we watched sanitation sweeps come through, people had to pick up their entire tents and move them across the street, and of course, things get left behind. Paperwork gets lost.
Do you think we take for granted how difficult it is for someone on the street to get a roof over their heads, considering how we always talk about how everything's so expensive for people trying to move into places?
I think we do take it for granted. I think that's basically the distance that lies between people that are on the street living in tents and the people that are living in homes and driving in their cars and commuting and holding jobs. I think that's one of the problems with this crisis that's facing the city, is it has created a huge divide between them and us. It's that distance between these two realities that I think is at the heart of this crisis that has led to us taking for granted how fortunate we are and how unfortunate they are.
Francine, reporting on homelessness is done all over the city, lots of different ways. How was it different in this series?
First of all, the Los Angeles Times has put in enormous resources to cover this humanitarian crisis in our city. This work is something special, I think. Tom and I pulled up chairs. We lingered. We spent a huge amount of time with people just simply listening to people without judgment. I've never in the work that I've done on the street carried a chair around in my back seat and just pulled the chair out and sat and listened and just spent time, such a vast amount of time. I think it really separates this work from other work.
The title of your series is called A Street Within. As we've heard, it's not exactly easy for the people who followed to shake off the habits of living on the street. It stays with them even behind closed doors. As one person put it to you, quote, "Homelessness is like that car. You can tow it, but you've got to open the hood to see why it's not running." What did you both take away about how LA is approaching the problem and how people are demanding solutions, Thomas?
I think we're working really hard in this city right now to try to figure out what the problems are. When people ask me, you know, what I'd recommend for remediating the homeless crisis in the city, I think it begins with just a large public conversation about it all. I think it's really important that we get the word out about what homeless is and what it means. The more we can inform people about this crisis, the more we can dispel some of the stereotypes and easy judgments that get put in the direction of the homeless that are living out there.
The LA Times series on homelessness is called The Street Within. The reporter is Thomas Kerwin, the photographer Francine Orr. Thomas, Francine, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Marvel Cinematic Universe might have to cut a superhero from its movie lineup, and it wouldn't be some low-level archer, I'm sorry, but no one would miss Hawkeye. No, this superhero is a big name, and right now he's ironically caught in a web of intrigue between Sony and Disney. Coming up, find out Those two studios may no longer be friendly neighborhoods for our hero. That's next when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Sony and Disney can't reach a deal over Spider-Man. So what does that mean for the character's future in the Marvel Cinematic Universe? Plus, mourning the death of the G rating. Let's go on the lot.
God is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is our showbiz guide as always. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
All right. Before we get into the news about the Sony-Disney fallout, let's get some context first. So what was the arrangement between the studios when it came to Spider-Man's character?
This was a very unusual arrangement. Almost all the Marvel characters now belong to Disney, but Spider-Man doesn't. His movie rights belong to Sony. The last two Spider-Man movies, the ones that starred Tom Holland, two studios had entered into this agreement where Kevin Feige, the Disney employee, president of Marvel Studios, actually produces Spider-Man movies for Sony. And Spider-Man is able to appear in Disney's Avengers movies. Seemed to be mutually beneficial. The latest Spider-Man movie was the highest grossing Sony movie ever. The latest Avengers movie is the highest grossing movie from any studio. So it all seemed to be working out pretty well.
Yeah, so everyone was making money. Everyone was happy. So let's fast forward to the present and news that broke yesterday. Sony told The Hollywood Reporter that negotiations between the studios were mischaracterized. So what is their side of the story?
Well, Sony says that Disney doesn't want to have Kevin Feige continue as lead producer on movies that the studio doesn't own. Since Disney acquired Fox, Feige just inherited a whole new stable of other characters, including X-Men and Deadpool, that he is now overseeing. So they don't like having his, now this is according to Sony, Disney doesn't want his attention spent on movies for another studio.
Okay, so if Sony then is moving forward on future Spider-Man films without Kevin Feige and the Marvel Cinematic Universe leading them, what does that mean for future Spider-Man films? Because a lot of people are hanging on to this little web. You get where I was going there, Rebecca?
I do.
Okay, well, they don't always work, Rebecca. Sorry.
It's a tangled web. It's an excellent question. So Kevin Feige is considered to have kind of a golden touch in this genre of film. But of course, there were Spider-Man movies before him. The star is the character itself. And Sony has had success recently with some superhero movies that Feige didn't work on for them. They made a Venom movie that made a lot of money. So I think they feel like they don't necessarily need Kevin Feige. They get what he does. That's good. They like him. But they can make Spider-Man movies without him.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, because if you look at the last couple of movies, Infinity War and Endgame, the Avengers, they were setting up Spider-Man as a very important character going forward. So I think a lot of people are wondering, well, what now? What does that mean? Is he not as important as he was a few months ago?
Yeah, I mean, the piece of this deal that has been unwinding that is probably of larger importance to fans is Sony's loaning of the movie rights of Spider-Man to Disney for the Avenger films. I mean, that is something that fans really like. There's no question that in the plotting of those films, he was central. So it is unclear, I think, at this point, what happens with that. It seems like the deal has fallen apart, that Tom Holland's Spider-Man will not be appearing in these future Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. It's always amazing to me when something that had been working and making a lot of money falls apart. So maybe talks could open back up.
Yeah, if Tom Holland is still attached somehow, I'll be feeling okay. But if he's not, then I might be done with that. All right, let's move on now to another Disney problem that may only be growing.
Quiet. Composed. Graceful, disciplined. These are the qualities we see in a good wife.
Now that's a clip from the upcoming live-action film Mulan, which is slated for release next year. Already running into controversy. Rebecca, catch us up on the controversy.
Crystal Liu, the Chinese star of the film, weighed in on Hong Kong's police crackdown of pro-democracy protesters. She wrote to her 65 million followers on the social media platform Weibo, quote, "I support Hong Kong's police. You can beat me up now." The response to that post, which, by the way, many other Chinese stars posted the exact same post. The response to that, though, was to call, was many people calling for a boycott of the Mulan movie.
And that puts Disney in a bit of a tough spot, doesn't it?
It did. It does. I mean, they've stayed quiet. They're really in a dilemma. They do an enormous amount of business with China, and they don't want to disrupt that business. At the same time, they're an American company with values ostensibly that are pro-democracy and against authoritarianism. They're in a very awkward position.
Yeah, we live in the cancel culture era. So when social media deems something to be canceled, sometimes that really sticks. All right, let's stick with our Disney theme and talk about the G-rated movies or maybe the decline of them.
Everyone, Bonnie made a friend in class.
Oh, she's already making friends.
No, she literally made a new friend. I want you to meet Forky.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
He's a spork.
Yes, yeah, I know.
Literally made a new friend. That's a clip from Disney and Pixar's Toy Story 4, which is one of two G-rated films this year. Rebecca, what's the landscape out there right now for G-rated films? They just really aren't around anymore, are they?
They are rare. I should say they're just two wide-release G-rated movies. There are documentaries that have smaller releases, like the Apollo 11 documentary was G-rated. But in wide-release, movies intended for big, broad audiences, the G-rating's gotten really rare. In fact, Disney is the last studio making movies with a G-rating. It's been 4 years since another studio made a wide-release G-movie, and that was Fox's Peanuts movie.
So what's the rating, then, that seems to be the sweet spot for studios nowadays?
Well, PG-13 is what all the top grocers are raters. That's the rating that draws the broadest possible audience. It still seems cool to teenagers. Adults can go. The G rating had become just uncool.
It's uncool and it's going away. I mean, will it disappear, you think, at this rate?
Well, it seems to be going that way. You know, in the 70s, there were a lot of different movies, kinds of movies that were rated G. The Pink Panther movies, the Star Trek movies, romantic comedies, and now we're down to just Pixar movies.
Wow. Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about all things entertainment. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And today we end on a sad note. Cumbia pioneer Celso Piña has died. He passed in his native Mexico of a heart attack earlier today. He was 66 years old. Piña was a singer, composer, arranger, and legendary accordionist, lauded for mixing genres with other Latino artists. Piña traveled the world, earning legions of fans in countries not typically exposed to his music, including Denmark, Sweden, and the Czech Republic. He was widely seen as a pioneer in the fusion of musical genres like cumbia, ska punk, reggae, rap, hip-hop, and R&B. Truly a Renaissance man. All right, that's going to do it for Take Two today. If you missed any part of the show, just go to wherever you get your podcast. Look for us. We'll be right there ready for you to listen whenever you want. We're also on social media as well, at Take Two. We're at Take Two. That's on Twitter. And I'm there on Twitter as well, A Martinez LA. That's A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.